Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Have you thanked your blood-brain barrier today? Probably not, but the fact is that our brains are protected from a variety of toxins by a layer of tightly packed cells that keep the blood in our bodies from infecting our central nervous system. In short, it keeps the bad stuff out of your brain and the good stuff in. But when the good stuff goes bad or grows unchecked into a tumor, there's trouble. That's because the same blood-brain barrier that keeps the bad stuff out can also inhibit treatment for brain cancer. Ohio State University researchers have found a way around, or rather through, the problem. Here to talk about that is Balveen Kaur. She is a neuro-oncology researcher at OSU and lead author of this study. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. So thanks for having me.
It's called glioblastoma, is one of the most aggressive forms of brain cancer. How do you treat it, and why is this barrier a problem?
So the standard of care is really surgical resection, followed by chemotherapy and radiation. The blood-brain barrier, which was really essential for the normal brain function, is a very serious problem for the delivery of drugs. So most chemotherapeutics are given systemically.
Okay. So you're taking them like
orally? So you're taking them orally or by IV as an injection. And they don't cross the blood vessels of the brain to reach the tumors that are inside the brain.
Okay.
And so while the tumors might actually respond really well to the drug, when it's given to the patients, the tumor never has access to sufficient quantities of active agent to see an effect. And so it's a pretty serious issue for drug delivery to intracranial tumors.
So what have you discovered, or what have you developed that has gotten you past this barrier?
So this is a collaborative effort between my lab and Dr. Kui's lab in University of Cincinnati. Okay. And Dr. Kui is really the inventor of this drug. And my lab has a large focus on intracranial brain tumor therapy. And so it was a very good collaboration. The drug is really a nanotherapeutic. It's like a ball of lipids, which has enclosed a special protein in it, which allows the protein to cross this barrier and target tumors inside the brain.
It's called SAP-CDAPs.
That's the protein that's embedded inside the lipid.
Okay, and the lipid, and when you talk about nano, you're talking about something that's really small.
Something that's really, really small.
And that's why it can get through the barrier.
So there's multiple reasons why it can reach intracranial tumors, and some of them we don't totally understand and we are still investigating. But a lot of these cancer cells have a very different cell membrane compared to the normal cells.
In the rest of your body?
In the rest of the body, and also the normal brain. And also the blood vessels that grow into these tumors have a very different cell membrane structure compared to the normal blood vessels. And we believe this nanotherapeutic targets these changes very effectively.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday, and I'm talking with Dr. Balveen Kaur. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly? Associate Professor and Vice Chair of Neuro-Oncology Research at OSU. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Kaur, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Once it gets across the blood-brain barrier, what does it do? How does it know to attack the tumor cells and not the brain?
So we believe it fuses with the membrane, because the membrane is also a lot of lipids.
Okay.
And it activates a certain cellular protein that normally is there in all cells, causing the lipid content of these cells to change from one form to the other. And this really causes a lot of cellular changes leading to cancer cell death.
And so they attach and then they can release.
Or do they attach and they are thus enter the cell by a process of fusion. And then it causes the lipids in the cellular, it activates a cellular protein acid sphingomyelinase, which can then cause the changes in the cellular lipids to change from a form which really sensitizes these cells to dye.
Brian in Pennsylvania, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Yeah, I think more people who have a family member who are going through brain brain cancer should have more information about this from their doctors, because my brother John had gone through had brain cancer, and he had to go through several rounds of different drugs because of the problem the doctor was talking about, and to battle his cancer, they finally had to do brain surgery. And after the brain surgery, he had a major stroke, and now he's institutionalized because the doctor said we found out later that if it wasn't for this phenomenon, he would have not had to have the surgery.
Okay, so this is also a way to avoid brain surgery, right?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, Dr. Kaur?
As a scientist, I cannot comment on that because we have not compared the two.
Okay.
Brain surgery, the debulking of the tumor, does have its advantages. It does come with a lot of risks. Brian, I'm very sorry for your brother's diagnosis. I do want to working in this field, I totally appreciate how devastating the disease is, not just to the patient, but his loved ones and family as well. A tumor debulking surgery does have advantages. It can improve the quality of the life of patients. But unfortunately, with all surgeries, there is always this inherent risk of an intracranial surgery is a risky surgery
This drug, SAPSIDAPS, isn't necessarily instead of surgery. We don't know yet whether it can, that's the case.
We don't know yet. And the reason we don't know yet is because we have done this in preclinical animal models. And its efficacy really in patients needs to be tested out in clinical trials. And that's something which we hope will happen in the near future.
Brian, thanks. Yep.
Both my parents had died of cancer. So, because cancer runs in our family, especially brain cancer.
Okay.
So, and I get myself a cancer screening every 6 months because I'm a high risk for brain cancer. So,
wow.
That's
a lot to live with, Brian. Thank you for sharing your story, though. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, Brian.
I know you didn't discover this drug. You're helping do the trials on it. But how does someone discover something like this? How you said we really don't know exactly how it does it, but it does it. How do you even get to the point then that you, if you don't know how it does it, why would you do it?
And that's a great question. As a translational scientist myself, my own lab has identified some gene therapeutics that work. And I think there are really two phases to that discovery. One is the basic science research, which I think is often not celebrated enough, but is actually way more innovative than the translational scientists. And the translational scientists, a lot of times, have a different way of thinking and applying what was identified in a basic science research to a problem in human health that exists.
Okay.
Sometimes as a translational scientist, I feel that I'm merely connecting the dots of identifying that, hey, somebody identified a certain substance has this property, and this is a property which can be exploited to do that. So I get a lot of recognition for merely joining the dots. And it's really a large amount of basic science research, probably not done by one scientist, but a whole history of science.
And you're seeing a trend in that you see enough research that says
that that we can make an application out of an invention that already existed is what happens most of the time.
We talked earlier about surgery, and you can't say whether or not this therapy would replace surgery for any given patient. But you have discovered that it seems to inhibit new growth of tumor cells. Is that right?
It can cause existing cancer cells to go to die as well.
Oh, okay. All right. So it inhibits growth.
It's not just prevention. We've actually seen slowing down of tumor growth of established tumors, because most of our models, we implant the tumors, let the tumors get established to a reasonable size before we treat them. And so that, I think, is more therapeutic than a prevention angle.
Do you think, as an applied, you said you are an what did you call yourself? Connecting the dots kind of person.
Yeah.
Do you think this drug has other applications? Could this mechanism be applied to other cancers or disorders that have similar kinds of barriers? Although you did describe this blood-brain barrier.
Sure, sure. That's a great question. This drug is currently being developed by Bexion. It's a small company that's invested heavily in developing this drug. They're doing a lot of safety toxicology studies, and they're very close to getting an IND to test it in human patients. The first set of patients that they really want to test it in is in brain tumors, but this drug can target cancer cells in several other tumor types. I know that it has been looked at in neuroblastomas, which is a pediatric disorder, and there's really no reason to believe why it wouldn't work in multiple tumor types as such. But we really need to test, because each tumor model is so different from a tumor that exists in a different part of the body. And there's so much heterogeneity in the molecular phenotypes of these tumors that these really need to be tested and evaluated on how broad the applicability of this agent would be for different cancer types.
When you do start human trials, would you necessarily be involved in those, or would it be that small company you mentioned?
So I'm a PhD, I'm not an MD.
Okay.
So as a scientist, I would not be involved in delivering the drug to the patients. But as a scientist, what I can be involved in is analyzing the samples from those tissues to identify if there was a biological effect of the drug, or if there wasn't. And then if there's the possibility to do a retrospective study to delineate what are the reasons why in any trial that happens, a certain set of patients would be responding and maybe a certain set of patients don't. And can we identify markers to separate out patients which might respond?
Because we're talking about the brain, so special, when human trials do start, and may not be able to answer this, I'm just curious, do you start with the worst and people who are the most serious patients, the one that are most on the brink, or is there a variety?
Typically, you're absolutely right. This is done on patients who have previously been heavily treated and the tumor has reoccurred. And typically in a phase one clinical trial, the goal is not to see an efficacy, but the goal is to see a maximum tolerated dose. And then that maximum tolerated dose would be used for in a second clinical trial to look at efficacy in patients. So typically a phase one trial would be done where a small group of patients would be given a very low dose and they would be evaluated very closely for any adverse events that could be attributed to the drug. And if those are not observed, then a higher dose cohort is given to the next set of patients, and so on, until a maximum tolerated dose is identified. And then that maximum tolerated dose is what would be used in a subsequent efficacy study given to a larger number of patients. So for safety studies, usually the patients that are involved are recurrent patients, heavily pretreated, very, very poor prognosis.
Well, Dr. Balveen Kaur, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. It's very interesting, and we have hope.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Dr. Balveen Kaur, she's Associate Professor and Vice Chair of Neuro-Oncology Research at Ohio State University. We'll continue Wellness Wednesday when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday. The good news, a host of studies suggests that the drug MDMA can be put to good use in treating psychiatric disorders. The bad news, recreational use of the drug MDMA, nicknamed Molly, has skyrocketed in recent years. MDMA-related hospital visits have doubled since 2004, and U.S. Customs and Border Protection say MDMA confiscations are up 1,400% in the last 4 years. The drug is illegally sold as a quote-unquote pure powdered form of ecstasy, temporarily improving mood and stimulating the senses. One problem, and there are many, is that recreational MDMA probably is not pure at all, but highly contaminated with dangerous synthetic fillers. Here to shed some light on the use of MDMA and abuses is Dr. John Halpern. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry at McLean Hospital at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Do you have a sense of why MDMA's abuse has increased so much in the last 5 years?
Well, there's always trends of drugs becoming popular and losing popularity. I think that the big wave with MDMA happened actually 10, 20 years earlier, but there has definitely been an uptick in use again overall.
And you've said that a lot of what's sold is Molly, which is its street name, in the United States actually contains no MDMA.
Well, MDMA or ecstasy on the street is typically purchased, pressed into a pill form. But some enterprising dealers have decided not to press it into a pill and then sell it for more, claiming that it must be a pure drug because it's never been pressed into a pill. Other people have even just ground up pills that they've purchased and then resold it as if it's quote-unquote Molly, saying for molecule or some approximation of the full name of MDMA, methylene dioxymethylamphetamine. And this is something that's, it is no safer this way. In the United States, statistics have shown that across the country, maybe as many as one out of five pills contain no MDMA whatsoever in it.
The drug you're studying and the stuff people are probably getting on the street are quite different, though, right? Even that one out of five, it's still different than what you're studying?
When you're doing a research experiment with a human subject, for sure you have MDMA that's pure and standardized and manufactured under good manufacturing and laboratory practices, none of which occurs when things are made illegally. So there is that difference between what people buy in the street and what's being used for research.
And the FDA approved medical MDA research in 2002, but the effects or the possible therapeutic effects of MDA go back to research from the 70s, right?
So MDMA, which is the drug that is considered ecstasy, does go back some ways with initial wave of publications in the 80s saying that it was useful in couples therapy and as a psychotherapy tool.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last dozen years, there have been a few studies in the United States and elsewhere, again using MDMA to assist psychotherapy for treatment of anxiety disorders, primarily post-traumatic stress disorder, currently a study of PTSD associated with people coming back from the Iraq War, so with veterans, and with people with anxiety associated with the diagnosis of advanced stage cancer, which is a study that I had initiated, in fact, too. So just because there's some research doesn't mean that there's FDA approval for it as a medicine.
Right.
This
right.
is how biomedical research occurs and how new discoveries are made.
Mm-hmm. But it's approved to be studied.
Every drug in the United States can be researched. Every single one. We don't live, thank God, in an Orwellian universe where because a drug has been labeled dangerous or a drug of abuse, then by definition it could never be researched even for any medical utility. We don't legislate on the back of patients the potential to find new and important medications. So even a drug with high potential abuse liability, if it has a known medical use in the United States, that drug should be made available for a patient's medical condition. That's why highly addictive drugs like morphine, even tincture of opium, or cocaine, mm-hmm. or ketamine, or methamphetamine, in fact, these are all Schedule II medications that can be prescribed by a physician.
My guest is Dr. John Halpern. He's an associate professor of psychiatry and a researcher at Harvard's Medical School. We're talking about a drug called MDMA. It's known as ecstasy or Molly on the streets. We're talking about the therapeutic treatments that are being researched, and Dr. Halpern is the research that he's involved in with that. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Oh, see, MDMA is considered a psychedelic drug. At least it is in a headline in a New York Times article. When it's given at the doses that you're studying it at, does it have those psychedelic, where hallucinogenic type of side effects or effects, or what does it feel like?
Okay, so although MDMA is listed as a psychedelic or a hallucinogen, it really is better described as an empathogen or an entactogen. That's something that amplifies a person's sense of touch and emotion, and it does it in a very pleasant direction. Typical psychedelics, especially at full doses, can cause loss of sense of self, loss of ego, and MDMA does not do that. There's a retention of sense of self. And so a person will experience waves of pleasure, waves of emotion, and could feel safe to explore then even very troubling type of material that in therapy would be very difficult to access even, because there's a boost of their ego during this pleasant experience. And this is probably why the drugs become very popular to abuse.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the doses used in research are comparable to what people are taking for intoxication. So it is at a real dose. I think that we have some indications that much lower doses can access some of the same benefits from a full dose, but more research needs to be done to evaluate that.
Similar doses, but you're not sending them out to a rave party at a bar somewhere. The circumstances of the therapy is much different. Can you tell us about that?
Well, of course, that's true. To conduct research in the United States with a Schedule I controlled substance is a very restrictive effort. And it's done under a controlled environment. People typically stay overnight with observation, and so there's multiple healthcare providers on tap in case there's any problem. And then there's the support system of hospital behind all of that should there be any complications, because life is precious. Research may be important, but we're not going to bring unnecessary risk to people who are volunteering for the project.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite different from somebody just with the very simple equation of you got the money, you get the drug. Mm-hmm. There's no quality control, and you can take as much as you want because there's no warning label saying you shouldn't even have above a certain amount. There's none of that missing. So it will make the drug more dangerous because there's no safe use instructions that have been that accompany the substance.
The research is conducted on volunteers who are actually go to hospital rooms. The hospital rooms are made to be not hospital-like, very good. tell us about the environment that people are tested in and what they actually do when they after they take the drug.
So, for example, the post-traumatic stress disorder study that's sponsored by the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies and led by Dr. Michael Mithoffer in particular. It's actually in an office setting in the community, not based in a hospital.
Okay.
And it feels very much like somebody's comfortable living room. And there, while there are some medical equipment available and there is an emergency room doctor available to the patient, there's a nurse there, and obviously there's a physician attendant, the person will typically, in very comfortable clothing, lie back in a comfortable chair or bed, at times with eyes shut, thinking about their situation, because it's all based within the psychotherapy that has been ongoing about what's led to the symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an exploration of the of those factors that are involved with the patient. And so there's a deepening of the therapy that occurs during the session, and then will continue after the MDMA has also worn off. So there's continued integration of the material that comes up that's a little bit different than what would occur normally without the benefit of the
Shay in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. John Halpern. Welcome, Shay.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
I was curious if you could explain some of the after effects of MDMA, sort of like the hangover effect that seems to be commonly talked about.
Okay. Dr. Halpern? We have lost Dr. Halpern. We will work on getting him back. Shay, if you want to hang on, otherwise we'll just hold that question until we can get him back. And we do have a few more minutes with Dr. Halpern once we get him back. So if you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. By the way, we're streaming live at wosu.org/allsides if you like to watch me look befuddled when I lose a guest in the middle of mid-sentence. You know how when you're on the phone with somebody and you just keep talking and you didn't know they hung up a while ago? You know that feeling? Well, that's how I've been.
All right, we're back.
All right, we're back. Okay. Our caller, well, Shay, why don't you ask that question again?
Oh, I was just curious if you'd explain the sort of hangover or after effects of taking MDMA, if there's a sort of down period after taking the drug.
Sure. So people typically, recreationally using it, will stay up through the night, like an all-night rave dance party, and they're exhausted afterwards. And on top of that, taking a drug that has some similarities with stimulants, with amphetamines, they're exhausted afterwards. And so it's very common for a person to describe it for a day to 3 days feeling tired, less mentally focused or sharp, and some people describe feeling down or moody in the days that follow. People with a history of depression or anxiety disorders in themselves or their family, and just observationally, clinically, seem to have a higher incidence of more severe complaints of moodiness or down feelings. But it typically lifts after just a few days.
Thanks a lot, Shay. So a lot, once again, we go back to the circumstances of taking the drug. It's very critical. In the studies, they're in a quiet room. They are listening to different kinds of music. They're at, it's all different. They're not drinking and dancing and staying up all night.
unless there's a study of about doing those things. No, the purpose of the research is to see if MDMA has any medical properties that existing medications can't provide. And some we're willing to tolerate, as I mentioned, a lot of side effects, even dependence with all sorts of medications, provided that it can achieve a real meaningful clinical improvement in a patient in the desired direction. You know, if you don't have cancer, and I give you certain type of chemotherapeutic agents that will shave 10 points off your IQ because they have some serious impact on brain function, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to say this is a horribly toxic drug. Well, guess what? Chemotherapeutic agents are horribly toxic drugs. That's why they kill cancers. And if you have cancer and it helps you live longer, you're going to say, I'll take my chances of having a slightly lower IQ in return for getting to see my kid graduate from high school. So we can understand that a drug has real and known risks to it, while at the same time accepting that there may be important medical properties. And accepting that a drug of abuse may have important medical properties does not send an unhealthy message to the community at large, mm-hmm. because it can help also for people to understand then what a drug really is intended for.
I was interested to read that that its positive impacts can last for days or weeks or months sometimes just from one treatment.
Right. As opposed to having to take an antidepressant medication daily for months to years or longer.
And why do you think that is, do we know?
I suspect part of it is, in fact, that there is some function that's unique to these types of compounds that may trigger a change in the expression of the disorder. In other words, maybe it shows some epigenetic properties that it alters the expression of the disorder for a longer period of time than just the exposure to the drug itself. But also, there may be unique opportunities then to work through material in psychotherapy while under the influence of these types of compounds that otherwise might take many, many months or longer. There was a researcher, psychiatrist named Hans Bastians, who first described PTSD. It was called back then ZD syndrome, and that was referring to concentration camp survivors. Mm. And he used low-dose LSD in psychoanalysis with patients and achieved some remarkable results and described how the LSD allowed people to speak about material that they consistently would avoid in therapy otherwise, and that the therapy was stuck, if not for the use of a very low dose of LSD, but then it was done. And this was done in the 1950s and into the 1960s with hundreds of people and safely done.
When you study the effect, are you interviewing study participants only, or are you actually studying what the effect is on the brain? Are you using brain scans and that sort of thing to look at what the chemical change is?
Right. So we don't have nice photographs that will show whether something is safe or dangerous per se. It can show changes in pathology, just the histology, you know, what's physically there. But that to ascribe causality to that is very difficult. Mm-hmm. We've done studies looking at the long term cognitive consequences of MDMA exposure. So we took people who had been going to raves and all night parties and have only used ecstasy, never used any other drug of abuse, except for a handful of times, but many, many, many times with just ecstasy. We hunted for just these virtually pure ecstasy users, and we compared them to people who also go to these raves and don't use any drugs whatsoever, so they're all similarly sleep-deprived.
Okay.
And we then had a blinded rater, a neuropsychologist, do hours and hours of neuropsychological testing on them. And this was published in 2010 in a peer-reviewed journal and was funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and showed that overall there's no differences between the users and non-users on most measures. Heavy users, people defined as more than at least 55 separate exposures in their life, showed some changes on measures of impulsivity. And But overall, did not show any serious pathology, such as verbal memory deficits and brain damage and whatnot. And the fact that these people had higher scores on impulsivity, well, we just don't know really whether there was something distinct about these people anyway that made them wind up using this drug so mm-hmm. many times. So mm-hmm. we can only take that so far. So that's one set of studies I've done. And then, as I mentioned, I had started a pilot study of actually administering MDMA to dying cancer patients. And that study terminated after just two participants because of lack of funding.
Well, Dr. John Halpern, we have a lack of time right now. I thank you for joining us today, though. This is very interesting, and I appreciate that you could join us and talk about it.
Thank you.
Dr. John Halpern, he's an associate professor of psychiatry and a researcher at Harvard's Medical School. Coming up, Dr. John Swartzberg of the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tradition has it that sometime in the mid-19th century, a restaurant chef trying to please a picky customer sliced up a potato paper thin, deep fried it crisp, and served it with extra salt. And I both curse and say God bless that man, the inventor of the potato chip. But it's unlikely at that time the chef knew that the process of frying that way had formed a substance which has garnered a reputation as a likely carcinogen. It's called acrylamide. And we've invited Dr. John Swartzberg back to the show to talk more about that and other recent news from the University of California Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Welcome back, Dr. Swartzberg.
Thank you for having me.
So, acrylamide and potato chips, not good.
Well, probably not good.
Okay.
We've known about, or been worrying about acrylamide for at least a decade. There were some Swedish researchers who pointed this out about 10 years ago, that this chemical may be carcinogenic, may have deleterious effects to the developing fetus and to very young children. So there's been worry about it. The World Health Organization has called it a probable human carcinogen, and people who have been exposed to incredibly large doses of it, primarily through occupation, have had damage to their nerves. So there's probably something here in terms of acrylamide being not good for our health.
It's not just about fried food either. There is evidence to suggest that dark roasts of coffee might be hazardous, that smoking might be part of the problem.
Yeah, you know, that really bothered me when I learned about that. The potato chips, at the Wellness Letter, we've been writing about the problems with the saturated fats and trans fats and so on. So, you know, we've been telling people to really take it easy on the potato chips. And the reason potato chips are a problem is because potatoes contain a lot of an amino acid called asparagine. And when asparagine is heated real high, like making potato chips, it goes through this chemical reaction that I had learned about in college called the Maillard reaction. And it combines with sugars and it produces acrylamide. So that's where it comes from. But as I said, what really bothered me was this dark roast coffee, because I love coffee.
I was going to say, I've gone to a lighter roast personally, and I was really happy to when I read that I've changed.
Right. I'm transitioning. It's probably the best way to put it.
So a dark roast means it's been heated. It's been roasted at a higher temperature?
Exactly. It's the same thing with that Maillard reaction with the asparagine that's in the coffee beans, and you heat it real high with the dark roasting, and the sugars combine with it and form this acrylamide. We don't know how big of a problem it is, but I think it makes sense for people to moderate their intake of products that contain a lot of acrylamide. And frankly, it's not hard to do. You know, you cut out those things that we were talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I try not to eat potato chips. I don't smoke. I drink a light roast coffee. But I was kind of, I was frustrated when you said that roasted potatoes, fried potatoes, which I don't eat often, but, you know, every once in a while you splurge. But the research is saying that they're only safe until golden, not crispy brown. And I like the crispy.
Yeah, I know. And a lot of people like their toast real brown, on dark brown on the outside, mm-hmm. and so on. You know, what you said, I think, tucked into that was really important. You said you occasionally have those products.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think occasionally is fine. It's just that if you're eating potato chips on a regular basis, if you're making toast and it's really dark and almost burned on the side all the time, well, maybe you should change those habits. There is one tip you can do with potatoes, though, mm-hmm. if you really want to have your potato and eat it too, sorry. potatoes form more of the asparagine if they're kept real cold, so don't put them in the refrigerator when you're storing them. They can be kept cool, but not cold, not below 46 degrees Fahrenheit, because then it forms more of the acrylamide-forming compounds.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say there's also an issue with grilling. Too.
Right. Yeah. Grilling, there's no way around grilling, really. If you grill it and you keep them off of the flame, so you grill it indirectly and you keep it as high as you can, those things will work. But otherwise, grilling is a problem. If you're going to bake, try to bake it at a lower temperature, like around 250 as opposed to 400. And that's going to form a lot less acrylamide, too. You know, the people who really need to pay attention to this are probably not as much you and me as it would be someone who's pregnant or infants and children. There, it's likely that, these are people that you don't want to have as much acrylamide in them, because we just don't know the long-term effects.
Well, I wasn't allowed to have a potato chip until I was in my teens, I think, so I'm probably in pretty good shape.
I think so.
Let's talk about the leaky gut. In your column this month in the UC Berkeley Wellness Letter, you write about the leaky gut syndrome, and that's kind of a catch-all term for intestinal disorders that seem to be on every doctor's mind these days.
Boy, it's really an interesting topic. There's the science of the what's called the microflora, and you and I have actually talked about this once in the past, all these bacteria that live in our gut, and the role they play in our health and in disease is exploding, that science. And it's so, so interesting. I think it's one of the most interesting things, certainly in my field, that I've seen in decades. The problem is that we don't know a lot about it yet, and there's an awful lot of people who are taking a little bit of truth here and a little bit of truth there and creating these really outlandish theories. About leaky gut specifically, there's a lot of interesting ideas about the fact that with damage to the lining of our intestines, maybe products from these organisms that reside in and are necessary for our health that live in our gut, maybe those products can quote, leak into our body and perhaps cause problems. There are some papers that suggest this, but I really want to underline suggest. We really don't know yet what role a gut that's damaged and products that might get into our body play. When we did this article and when I wrote this editorial, I looked in the internet and I found probably around 60 diseases that people had claimed are caused by leaky gut syndrome, when there's not one of those where there's hard scientific evidence, or even strongly suggestive scientific evidence that leaky gut causes that. So the claims that are being made for a problem with this entity are really outlandish. And even worse, on the internet, I found all sorts of people proclaiming all sorts of treatments for this, enemas, different things, ways to eat things, all sorts of crazy diets. None of it makes any sense. There are doctors preying on patients that have chronic symptoms and saying, well, you have leaky gut, and put patients on really strange things. So I think the take-home message is this is really an interesting topic, but don't take it to the bank yet that your problems are due to a leaky gut syndrome.
I never even heard of it before, but now I'm I'll try to resist the urge to blame all my aches and pains on that. As a former newspaper reporter and editor, I found the article about menu manipulation eerily familiar.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We had a lot of fun when we researched this topic. Certainly, if you own a restaurant, you want to have people spend as much money as possible. And there's actually some science about how to get them to do it. And we found all sorts of things that restaurants do in terms of their menus. One of them, there was an interesting study out of Cornell that talked about what's called the sweet spot on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
It was previously thought to be in the upper right-hand quadrant of the menu. That's where people's eyes tended to go, and they tended to order more from that part of the menu. More recent research suggests that there are really what are called sour spots, where people's eyes don't go, and that tends to be at the bottom of the page. So if you're ordering from the menu, if you see something at the top of the page, particularly in the right-hand column, realize that you may be being manipulated to order something from there.
You know, I mean, I've always read the menu from back to front. I think it's because I want to check out the desserts first to see if there's anything worth saving myself for. But apparently that's abnormal. Most people read it like a book.
They do read it like a book, and that's really interesting. So if you're reading something like a book, it's where you end up on that book that is the most likely place you're going to buy something. And that's why the more recent research suggests that it may be right at the bottom of the page where you're looking just at the main course that you're ordering. You know, there were other things that they had. There was a study from the University of Illinois that found that the more evocative the description of the product, the more likely you were to order it. So, for example, if you had grandma's zucchini cookies, you're more likely to order that than if they just had on the menu zucchini cookies. They found that if the price was written with a dollar sign, you're less likely to order that than if it was written without a dollar sign.
I noticed that in really fancy restaurants, they don't use the dollar sign.
Right, right. So that was interesting. Who knows how we're being manipulated with that? But there was some good advice that we found and that we wrote about. That is, take a long time reading the menu. Don't feel rushed. Read it carefully. Ask the wait person about questions you have, and then maybe pause after that and say, well, give me another minute. And really spend some time with that and figure out what you really want as opposed to what maybe the restaurant's manipulating you into wanting.
Portion sizes are an issue on fast food menus, and they've been they've had kind of a negative impact on advertising their portion sizes.
Yeah, we found in looking at the research on that it's the small, medium, and large kind of advertising or portions, and it's purposely done that way because naturally, the restaurant or fast food place is going to want you to order the largest size possible. But what's found is that, or what you should do, is order the smallest size possible, even if the medium size is just a little bit more, because the small size is probably more than you need or more than you even want. I mean, the portion sizes have just dramatically increased over the last two decades.
I thought it was interesting that they use decoys and to watch for decoys.
You mean like having salad offered or not offered as one of the side dishes?
Yes, that or putting expensive next to inexpensive.
Oh, yeah. They're decoys in terms of the foods they'll put there. For example, they'll offer you French fries or salad, and even just by having the salad there and having you think about the salad, you may order the French fries because you feel, well, you thought about the salad.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, it's really remarkable. And then the idea of putting health, other healthy foods next to other less healthy foods, they're doing that all the time. You made the one other point, and I just forgot it. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Just about putting expensive next to inexpensive.
So, yeah, they put menus will always have a really high-priced product that rarely people will buy, like the $35 or $40 steak.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll look at that and say, well, I'm not going to buy that. Then the $25 steak doesn't seem like it's that much.
Right. Yeah, not so bad. Kind of like looking at the salad saying, well,
right.
At least I thought I was doing something right.
Right. And did you see the part about the music?
Yes,
you know, it
yes.
drives me crazy. I don't hear as well as I used to, and neither does my wife. And so we try not to go where it's really loud. But mm-hmm. And I wonder, why do they make it so loud? Well, the reason they make it so loud is restaurants that play really loud music, you wind up chewing faster.
Interesting.
And you leave sooner so they can get a bigger turnover.
Oh.
And also, loud music tends to make people drink more so they can sell more drinks.
Ah, well. That makes sense. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you so much for joining us again today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Always fun.
Dr. John Swartzberg, he's chair of the editorial board at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher, listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.